Today, I'm going to ask you to cut me some slack. Not that you usually don't. You usually do cut me slack. But today, I really need you to cut me some slack. And here's why. A long time ago, I learned from a Protestant minister something that I have valued and I try to implement. And I learned something about preaching. And he taught me that every sermon should have three parts to it. It should be what, so what, now what. What, so what, and now what. I also use the image of whenever I preach, I use the image of taking my audience on a trip. And I compare the homily to, you know, a takeoff, going to the runway, a takeoff, the main part of the trip. And then at sometimes the captain will come on and will say, ladies and gentlemen, we are now beginning our descent, so that you kind of know when you're starting the last part. And then you got to have the airport in sight so that you know where you're going to land this thing. So the reason I'm asking you to cut me some slack is, let me give you the lay of the land of what I want to communicate with you. And this is the part that is, I can see the connections in my head, but seeing the connections and communicating to you the meaning of the connections are two different things. So let's go into the what. You would have had to be living under a rock to not know what's been going on the last 2 days in the United States. We have had the inauguration of the most controversial president in the history, I think, of the United States. Now, this is not going to be I'm for Trump or I'm against Trump. This is beyond Trump and beyond the Democrats. But it has been and continues to be, and I think it may continue to be in the next 4 years, a very wild ride. And I have always believed that a church and a priest who ignores the obvious challenges that are affecting his people is not doing fully his job. In other words, if I just gave a homily today that was completely divorced from anything that was going on in the society and just gave you a holy homily on maybe what the readings are, I think that what that does is it disconnects religion and our faith from what's really going on. And I believe that our faith has to inform and give us a sense of a viewpoint from which to look at the things that are going on in our lives. So that's number one, what. So I may not deal with these in order, but that's one what. Two what. Today it is 40 years, I think, 40 or 50 years since the decision of the Supreme Court of Roe versus Wade. And if you're not familiar with that Supreme Court decision, it is the decision when the court decided that babies in the womb were not to be considered human, and that therefore anyone at any time and for any reason could kill a baby in the womb, and it was not protected in any way, shape, or form. And since that day, over 1 million people have been killed in the womb because we have not given them the dignity of being a human being. That's a big number two, what? And we're remembering that day. We do that every year here on this Sunday. And then number three, what, is the readings today. The readings, each priest who does a homily really has to look very closely at the readings that the church has picked for today. And the issue for any homilist is to see if the celebration of the Eucharist, the readings, shed any light on what's going on in our personal lives and what's going on in the life of society. Because that's how we learn to try, at least, to see things from God's point of view. And so, the reason I asked you to cut me some slack is because I really want to try to do that for you and for myself. And I think I have an idea of where to take this. But I always quake a little when I take this microphone, because I still have a recollection of a graduate school professor of mine who used to say, it is a sin to bore people with the gospel. I think it's a sin sometimes committed by priests quite a bit. But it is a sin to bore people with the gospel. So, having said that, let me get into the body of what I'd like to try to communicate to you. First of all, let me begin with the first reading. Because the first reading, you know, I've been lately studying the Old Testament quite a bit. And the first reading, if you don't know just a little bit of the history of what's going on, doesn't make any sense to us who are almost 2,500 years after the events that are being described. Many of us have heard through novels and TV and discussions about the lost tribes of Israel. And that sometimes is made into the source of movies and stuff, of the lost, the 10, there's supposed to be 12 tribes, and the 10 lost tribes of Israel. And the reference to the 10 tribes of Israel is actually a historical one. Because you see, Israel began, was led, and was as 12 tribes. And the tribes in the north, see, Jerusalem's in the middle, but the tribes in the north, the 10 tribes, were sometimes somewhat separate from the tribes south of Jerusalem. And in the years after Israel settled in the Promised Land, several hundred years later, different enemies began conquering. The ancient world was full of different armies that were conquering. And when somebody conquered your city, it was not pretty, because cities were somewhat smaller. And what would happen was, I mean, it would be hard to do that to something like Houston, Texas, although it's possible. But when a city was conquered, whatever the army that was conquering it would almost level the whole thing, literally taking picks and axes to the walls of the city. They would kill all the men, or most of the men, in the streets. Women and children could be killed too. There was blood everywhere. And it would be similar to some of the things that you've seen the scenes of World War II, and even beyond, when an entire city was destroyed and people were being killed left and right, and what we would consider war crimes were being committed. That happened to Israel several times. But today, in the reading from Isaiah, Isaiah is speaking about a conquering that occurred, I'm pretty sure, by what's called the Assyrians. And they conquered the 10 tribes of Israel, the top 10. They never got to the south, where Benjamin and Judah, the tribes of Benjamin and Judah were. But they obliterated them. I mean obliterated them. So much so that they took people into exile. They never came back. They sooner or later began to mix with the Gentiles. It was chaos. Imagine that, let's say, a Russian or Chinese troops would literally invade the United States and drop nuclear bombs on the Capitol, on New York, and there was blood on the streets. The amount of confusion and fear that there would be. And that's how the people felt. And the people at that time were scared to death. And they started asking themselves the question, aren't we supposed to be the chosen people? Where's God? Where is God in all of this disaster? And yet, it was happening. And that's when Isaiah comes in. And this has already happened. And he makes a prophecy. And this is the prophecy. Now, the land of Zebulun and Naphtali are the two regions that were conquered first and obliterated first. And people were sent away in slavery and killed, all kinds of brutal things. And that's when Isaiah says, first the Lord degraded the land of Zebulun and land of Naphtali, but in the end he has glorified the seaward road, the land west of the Jordan, the district of the Gentiles. Why do you think it's called the district of the Gentiles? Because the Jews were just totally destroyed. Anguish has taken wing. Dispel this darkness, for there is no gloom where but now there was distress. Notice the hopeful that the prophet is saying, that this is not forever. And the people who walked in darkness, what the darkness? The darkness is their cities have been destroyed, their families have been killed. And they have seen a great light upon those who dwell in the land of gloom. A light has shone. You have brought them abundant joy and rejoicing as they rejoice before you and the harvest. Anyway, and it finishes on from there. So the very first thing that you're hearing is a prophecy about a people in total confusion, totally defeated, scattered among the Gentiles. And Isaiah saying, this is not the end. God's promise to you is still valid. Even though you look around you and you go, God has failed us. He said that the kingdom of David would be forever, but God has failed us. The God of the Assyrians was more powerful. And Isaiah is making a promise, prophecy saying, the only thing that has failed you is that fact that you have no idea of the power of God. And that his promise to you was not that everything was going to be easy, but he promised that you were his chosen and he would win in the end. So that's what number one. And then, of course, you notice that Jesus begins. The story of Jesus is the beginning of him gathering the 12 apostles, which, by the way, there's no accident that there were 12, because what he's doing is he is reconstituting Israel, the 12 tribes, which is why he picks 12 apostles. And where does he go first? The very first place he goes are the very first regions to be destroyed by the Assyrians. That's why it says in the gospel that Jesus went immediately. He left Nazareth and went to live in Capernaum by the sea in the region of Zebulun and Naphtali, because that's where the destruction had begun. And Jesus was going there to fulfill the prophecy with 12 apostles, saying that he was reconstituting Israel. Now, I'm not going to go further than that. Now, what I've tried to describe to you is a time of confusion, a time of despair, a time of fear, a time of not knowing where the heck God is and where these people are going. So now let's talk about the election. And now let's talk about the inauguration. And now let's talk about the marches that have been going on, and the people screaming. They were supposed to say there were over 500,000 people yesterday in the mall. I find it somewhat disingenuous, because some of the reporters were saying this is the biggest march that has ever come down on Washington. And that's not true, because what they never tell you is that at least the statistic I saw for 2013, the March for Life had 650,000 people, which is much more than yesterday's. But this is not about that. But it's just a side issue that yesterday's march, which was chiefly, if you think about it, chiefly it was keeping women's reproductive rights. Now, you know what reproductive rights is code for. It's code for the right to abort. That's basically what it means. It was also basically just the desire to keep the United States moving in the direction that it has for so many years. And I'm not saying Barack Obama did a bad job all the way around, but there were several things, such as continued abortion, and such as gay marriage, and other areas in which we were moving that really were not good. And as a Christian, I have had to speak against them. And so yesterday you have this, yesterday and the day before, the inauguration, the election, and the all of this, you had this humongous crash. And today we are a nation probably more divided, I think, than we have ever been since the Civil War, when slavery was the fight that was being picked. And a lot of us are scared. A lot of us don't know where this is all going. And there's a sense of unsureness about our nation, about our place in the world, and even our leaders. Now, we're not being destroyed like the ancient Israel was, but there's that same anxiety, that same sense of what's going on and where is God in all of this. And one of the things that I have learned about studying the Old Testament is that God does not ever provide you with easy answers. One of the things you learn in studying, especially the Old Testament, but in the New Testament too, is that if you're looking for an answer that explains everything, you know, and you look in the Bible and you say, ah, the Bible says this, the Bible says that, the Bible says this, you're not going to find the answer. Because one of the things you learn is that when you study the Bible is not one book. It's written by hundreds of different people. And God did not change those people's minds. And there are contradictory statements and beliefs in the Bible. The Bible's full of arguments that it's having between the authors of each other. And the main issue that is being talked about is, what's the meaning of what's going on? How should we understand war? How should we understand death? How should we understand why bad things happen to good people? How does this happen? Doesn't God care anymore? And that is an entire question that throughout the entire Old Testament, that's what's being argued about. And in the New Testament, it's ultimately much of the same. The reason is, I always imagine Mary, the Blessed Mother. And take Mary, and she is almost the embodiment of the argument that's going on in the Old Testament. I want you to imagine Mary standing at the foot of the cross. Now, our cross behind us is very stylized, okay? It's tall, it's very well crafted. The cross of Jesus, Mary, who would have been standing right below the cross of Jesus, the top of Jesus' head on the cross might be where the top of this ornament is, this wall thing, so that his head would have been here, and his body would have been here, and his feet would have been right here. She was up close and personal. And Jesus was most probably totally naked. And Jesus was bleeding from every orifice that you can imagine, torn up. Now, those of you who are mothers, and especially mothers and fathers, I want you to imagine standing there before your son, or your daughter for that matter, and watching them being torn apart, and watching people laugh at them, and teasing them totally naked in the middle of an execution. How do you feel? How do you feel? And as a mom, all I can imagine is Mary looking up at this scene and then having to look up at God and say something like, "Didn't you tell me that I was going to be blessed among women? Isn't that your promise? Do you call that blessed among women? That I have to sit and stand before this, seeing my son torn apart? Is that being blessed among women? Is this how you keep your promises to people who have tried to serve you and done nothing wrong? Is this what we can expect?" And you might imagine that some of the people in Israel in the ancient world, when they were being conquered, they were asking the same questions. What the heck does this mean? Didn't you promise us? And that the whole issue is, how do you interpret? And this is the classic question. How do you interpret when bad things happen to good people? You can imagine at least interpreting bad things, you know, that the old Hindu thing of karma. You know, that's easy to understand. You put bad out, you get bad back. But what happens when you're a righteous person, a good person, and you get smashed in the end? And the question is, well, where the hell is God in all of this? And that's a lot of the Old Testament, and that is certainly the situation in the cross. And that woman, Mary, she had to leave that situation. And in some way, the Bible doesn't say it, but in some way that woman had to look up at God and say, I do not understand this. I do not understand. How could you let this happen? But even though I do not understand, I trust you. I trust you because you see things beyond what I can see. And I trust your promise. Now, we're not even close in terms of those kinds of disasters. But I think that's where we're at. I think a lot of us are in terms of, you know, depending on which side of the aisle you were, you're either in confusion or you're hopeful or whatever you are. Sometimes I just feel like I'm dizzy. But it teaches me one thing, that faith is not an answer. Faith, let me put this down very carefully. Faith is not an answer. Faith is an act of trust in God in the middle of no answers. Let me say it again. Faith is an act of trust in God in the midst of darkness. No answers. And we as Christians have to continue with faith. No easy answers. No easy answers that God's going to bless our country. Because one side is saying God blessed and got Trump elected. The other side is saying good did not win yesterday and God will win in the future. And who is right? All we can do is say, you know what's going on. I, as a Christian, need to live my life doing the best that I can and trusting in you, even though I do not understand. And so, let me bring this in for a landing. Today, Roe versus Wade, we remember over 1 million children being killed. Today, struggle in our society. It's not going to let up, folks. We as Christians cannot settle back and say, well, we either won with Trump being elected or we either lost, whatever, right? I don't know. What we have to do is continue being who we are, continue trusting in God, continue standing up for what needs to be stood up for. And today, we're focusing in on children in the womb, on saying, I don't care what society is saying. We trust the fact that we are sons and daughters of God and that we will stand for the life of every single human being, especially those who are innocent, and we will fight for them. And whatever the conditions may be, we will fight for them. And then we trust God. Because there are no guarantees of either winning or losing. Jesus' life ended in total disaster. And yet, it was God who saw the possibility that no one else did, the resurrection. God is always faithful to his promises. Faith does not give you easy answers. There's something actually called the God of the gaps. You know what the God of the gaps is? When you can't explain something, you say, oh, stuff it with God. That must mean that God is in charge. Nah. We don't understand. And I'll leave you. This is me coming in for a landing. And I'll leave you with this. My favorite image in times like this, if you can imagine a tapestry. A beautiful tapestry. What tapestry is those things that hang on the wall? They're made out of cloth and they have beautiful pictures on them. And they're all stitched by hand. But if you look at a tapestry from the back, 100% confusion. You cannot tell what the heck is going on in the front part of the tapestry. The Christian is the person who is looking at the back of that tapestry and saying, I do not understand, but I trust that from God's side, there's a design. And I will trust in His design for the rest of my life. And so wherever you are, whatever your situation is, have courage. Trust in God. I have no idea where we're going. No idea at all. It could be awful. It could be good. It could be a mixture. It's going to be a ride for sure. And so keep your focus on trusting God. Do your best in the political arena, but never make that primary. Your relationship with God is numero uno. That's the only thing that's going to keep you sane. God bless. Thank you.